Mr. Allport.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Peter Allport, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Sharif Miller. Mr. Miller was convicted in 2009 of three counts of violating federal firearms and narcotics statutes. However, we request that this panel reverse Mr. Miller's conviction and grant him a new trial for the reasons set forth in our brief. Today, I would like to address two issues that we believe conclusively establish why Mr. Miller's conviction should be reversed. First, the affidavit that supported the search warrant in this case was so bare bones and so lacking in probable cause that it cannot be saved by the good faith exception in U.S. v. Leon.
That's a hard argument to make, given that a U.S. district judge, after a full review, found that there was probable cause. How are the agents supposed to be smarter and better attuned to the law than a U.S. district judge?
Well, Your Honor, we feel that the U.S. district judge made an error in this case.
Of course, I understand you think the U.S. district judge made an error. But I assume you think that Judge Barker is a reasonable person.
Right? Judge Kendall, yes, Your Honor.
Under Leon, unless the agents were so wacky, unless the affidavit was so full of nonsense that no reasonable person could find probable cause, you don't use the exclusionary rule. And that's where I started. Here we have a full hearing before a U.S. district judge who says there's probable cause. And you are coming to us and saying the U.S. district judge was completely whacked out, and therefore no reasonable person could have found probable cause. I'm inclined to think U.S. district judges are reasonable people.
Your Honor, I think U.S. district judges are reasonable people, but they do make unreasonable errors sometimes, and we think this is one of those cases. And we believe, and officers are charged in effecting searches under U.S. v. Kurth, are charged with knowing the law.
Do you know of any case where Leon has been found inapplicable to a search that a U.S. district judge found was supported by probable cause? Any case at all?
Your Honor, I cannot think of one off the top of my head, but I think this is exactly the type of case.
I couldn't find one after a search either.
But, Your Honor, I think this is exactly the type of case because in U.S. v. Kurth, this court helped establish a boundary between when a good faith exception can save a search warrant and when it can't. And in there, it held that an uncorroborated affidavit that was sparsely detailed, provided by a confidential informant with no separate indicia of reliability, does not get the good faith exception. And we think that's the case here. The government concedes that there was no corroboration by the police. The affidavit itself only contained two conclusory details regarding illegal conduct at Mr. Miller's house. It was obviously provided by a confidential informant, and there was nothing else in that affidavit to establish the informant's reliability. And we think the government does tries to pull this affidavit back across the boundary of to where good faith should apply, and they point to U.S. v. Peck. And while Peck is a close case in this case, and the court found there was no probable cause there, we think it's distinct from this case for two very important reasons. First, while the court found there was no probable cause, it found there was some indicia of illegal drug dealing at the defendant's house for the good faith exception to apply. However, that was based on the affirmative representations of the defendant to the informant, where he showed her two packages and said, this one contains cocaine, this one contains marijuana, and I'm planning on selling these. Here, this affidavit contains Mr. Miller made no affirmative representations regarding anything in his house, and he never made any affirmative representations regarding planning selling anything.
That really doesn't tell you anything about the credibility or reliability of the informant, right, in terms of Peck. I thought in your brief you were trying to distinguish Peck on the supposed prior relationship between the CI and the suspect.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that was the second thing, is we think in that case the CI's reliability was enhanced by the personal relationship between her and the defendant.
Which way does that cut? Given our concerns about malice, spite, and so on, where you've got anonymous or confidential informants.
Well, I believe, Your Honor, in Peck, the court found that cuts in favor of the government because it makes it more likely that that personal relationship makes it more likely that she knew drugs were in the defendant's house. And there is no allegation of that personal relationship in this case. However, independent of the court's failure to grant the motion to suppress, Mr. Miller's conviction should also be overturned for the independent reason that the district court improperly admitted evidence regarding Mr. Miller's distinct prior bad act of possessing a handgun in February 2008 under the defunct inextricable intertwinement test that the government offered to prove Mr. Miller's propensity to commit the crimes charged here. The government in its brief does not contest the fact that it was error to admit this evidence under the inextricable intertwinement test. However, it seeks to recast this evidence as direct evidence of Mr. Miller's guilt. However, this evidence cannot be direct evidence because we clearly have two distinct alleged acts. One is Mr. Miller's alleged possession in February, one in April. And we know they're two distinct alleged acts because Ms. Borko, the government's witness, testified that on March 28, 2008, another man named Marcel Winston exercised sole and absolute control over that handgun when he came to her house and pointed it at her. Now, as numerous evidence treatises define it, direct evidence is evidence that proves a fact without an intervening inference or presumption. For Mr. Miller's possession in February to have any relevance to his possession in April, it requires the...
What does his possession in April have to do with this case? Your brief seems to be premised on a belief that Miller is guilty only if he possessed the gun at the instant he was arrested. So I understand the law. He's guilty if he possessed the gun any time within 5 years before the date of the indictment.
Well, Your Honor, the government charged Mr. Miller with possessing the gun that was recovered from the house on April 21st.
This was evidence that he had that gun in his hand.
But he no longer... Our point of trial is that he no longer possessed the gun at that point. And that's proven and that's demonstrated by...
You're not getting the point that I just made. He didn't have to possess the gun at the time he was arrested. It was enough if he possessed it any time within 5 years before he was indicted. The crime is possessing the weapon, not possessing the weapon at the instant you're arrested. And this was evidence that he possessed the weapon, this weapon.
Yes, Your Honor, it was evidence that he possessed this weapon, but we don't believe that's what he was charged with by the government.
He wasn't charged with possessing some other weapon.
No, he was charged with possessing this weapon. Yes, Your Honor.
On or about a certain date in April.
Right? On or about a certain date in April when
it was. Did the jury get the reasonable within a reasonable time instruction?
Your Honor, I do not know that off the top of my head. But we believe because it was not direct evidence, because it required the intervening inference that Mr. Miller recovered possession of it, it was evidence of a prior bad act that the government offered to prove Mr. Miller's propensity, namely that because he possessed this in February, he possessed it in April. And we believe this is more than just a harmless error. It substantially prejudiced Mr. Miller's case because outside of Ms. Borko's testimony, there was only a minimal amount of evidence that tied Mr. Miller to the handgun. For example, it wasn't found in his actual possession when he was arrested. There was no physical evidence such as a fingerprint tying to him. The government freely admits it was found hidden between the mattress and and the bed spring in a room that three witnesses testified to was not Mr. Miller's. On top of that, the government's own witness testified that another man had possession of the handgun and testified that this man lived in the same residence as Mr. Miller. Therefore, it's very likely that a jury would have concluded without this testimony that the handgun did not belong to Mr. Miller, it belonged to Mr. Winston. On top of this, we believe it didn't only prejudice Mr. Miller with respect to possessing the handgun, it prejudiced him with respect to possessing the drugs. Because the government admits, as the government states, Ms. Borko's testimony regarding the handgun tied Mr. Miller to the handgun, which in turn directly linked him to the drugs because it was recovered from the same room. As a result, we believe that the jury, without this testimony, the jury would have likely concluded that not only the handgun, but the drugs belonged to Mr. Winston. Now, Your Honors, there are no more questions. I will reserve the remainder of my time, but we request that this court overturn Mr. Miller's conviction and grant him a new trial.
Mr. Allport. Mr. Cole.
May it please the court, counsel. The search warrant in this case was not the fullest search warrant this court has ever seen. But based on the totality of the circumstances, the search warrant was, in fact, supported by probable cause. Written in the warrant by the John Doe, signed by the John Doe in front of the state court judge, was information about his personal appearance in the home of the defendant within the past 3 days, that he saw four.
How do you distinguish Peck on the issue of probable cause?
Say that again, Your Honor.
How do you distinguish United States against Peck on the issue of probable cause? I know it helps you on good faith, but I have trouble distinguishing it on the issue of probable cause.
I think there were several times, you know, for example, in our search warrant, the informant indicated that there were several times within the past month, in fact, that he was in the house. And on a few of those occasions, he did observe drugs. So it wasn't just the one occasion within the past 72 hours. I think it's more than that. I think there's more information in it than was in Peck in that regard.
There's no detail, no corroboration, unknown reliability. All those are the same between Peck and this case, right?
Well, I think there is somewhat more detail in just more times visiting the house. But I think there is a lack of detail in this warrant. I think that is correct. But the personal appearance, the notation by the CI that he's very familiar with crack cocaine, the fact that he did say he saw four large plastic bags, each containing several smaller plastic baggies, each with a white rock-like substance, is sufficient detail. And I think it's also just the totality of the circumstances of this, Your Honor.
It sounds like you're arguing for a rule on probable cause that would say the police can bring in anybody before a judge with any incriminating information, make no effort to corroborate it, and get a search warrant.
That is not the rule we're arguing for. I think.
Okay. Distinguish that position from yours.
Okay. Because I think there is some amount of detail in it, in the affidavit. I think the 72 hours is very important. The personally observed the crack cocaine within 72 hours. The detail about the amount of drugs was sparse, but definite. It was four large plastic bags, each containing smaller plastic baggies. So this was a sparse search warrant affidavit.
Look, if the informant is not reliable, detail doesn't help, right?
Absolutely true.
And we've got unknown reliability, no effort to corroborate.
I think the reliability was addressed, at least to some extent, by bringing the informant before the judge.
Who was silent. Right? And the informant, was there any record that the judge asked any questions?
Certainly none that I could find, Your Honor. We don't know one way or the other.
Well, let's assume, since the record is silent, there's nothing else that's there. What does the silent witness add to the probable cause determination?
I think he adds the opportunity for the judge to ask questions if the judge so desires. And
I'm now getting lost. Fourth Amendment says warrants have to be supported by oath or affirmation. So how can we rely on anything other than what is given on oath or affirmation?
Well, I think there are many cases where this court has indicated that it helps in the reliability of the informant if the informant is brought before the judge who is issuing the warrant. And it gives the judge the opportunity.
A technical question about the Constitution. Constitution says oath or affirmation. You're saying look at something that's not supported by an oath or affirmation. How is that consistent with the Fourth Amendment?
Well, I think what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that what's in the four corners of the affidavit is what the judge has to rely on. But in terms of assessing the credibility of the information, it's something that the judge can rely on personally observing the individual who is attesting to his personal observation of the drugs.
That just sounds contra-constitutional. Sounds like you're urging us to ignore the actual text of the Constitution and do something we prefer instead.
There are many cases where this...
That's It's something I expect to hear from the United States.
Well, I think there are many cases, Your Honor, where this court has indicated that the fact that a informant was brought before the judge issuing the warrant is a factor the judge can rely on.
Is the theory that the judge says his signature looks sincere?
No, I don't think so. It's the ability to go face-to-face with the informant and to ask the informant questions.
If you ask the informant questions under oath, they surely count. Mm-hmm. If you don't, we're supposed to be limited to what is under oath. It's what the Constitution says.
Counsel, isn't the problem really that we don't have a record when you go before a state court judge, the state court judge swears the witness, the informant in this case, and no record is kept?
That's my understanding, Your Honor, is there is no record kept, and so we just don't know one way or the other what happened. And so we do have to gauge it on what is in the four corners of the affidavit and the personal appearance of the informant. I would say, however, that under Leon, that even if the search warrant was not supported by probable cause, certainly the officers who executed the warrant had a good faith basis to believe that it was a valid warrant. The officer did go to the judge and do exactly what we would want him to do. He went to get a warrant. Even if this court believes the warrant was not sufficient and that there should have been more detail and more explanation of the reliability of the informant, the execution of the warrant was proper.
Well, of course, what you just said is, for all we know, the state judge did that, but foolishly didn't make a record that he did that.
I think it is the practice of the state not to make a record in these circumstances when someone is brought before the state court judge.
Well, if it's the practice in Illinois not to make a record, then under the Fourth Amendment, none of that counts. It's just perfectly straightforward.
I think just the four corners of this affidavit, sparse though it is, does contain sufficient information to support the finding of probable cause by the magistrate judge who issued the warrant. I would also like to move on to the second issue raised by the appellant, which is the firearm, the gun that Chandra Borco testified she saw the defendant with several months prior to the April 2008 arrest.
Our time is short. I would like to take you to the use of prior drug dealing to show intent. I don't understand how intent was an issue in this case. If I understand the defense was that the drugs just weren't Miller's, right? He's never denied that if they were his drugs, he would have been delighted to distribute them, would have intended to distribute them. But there certainly isn't any rule that if a professional drug dealer is in a room full of drugs and they're somebody else's, he's committing a crime. So since his defense seemed to have nothing to do with intent, what was the point of this evidence?
Well, intent is always at issue, Your Honor, in a specific intent.
No, intent is not always at issue. I mean, we have held the contrary in Beasley. We held the contrary in Hicks. Your brief ignores Beasley and kind of makes light of Hicks. Right? We have held that it is not always an issue. It is often not an issue.
Well, in this case in particular, it was an issue, and let me explain why. The first reason is that the district court waited to admit this evidence prior until she heard what the defense would be, and it was just
like you all brought it out in your opening.
Yeah, prosecutor brought this out from the outset. What we said in Hicks is that it may make sense for the prosecutor to wait, see what the defense is, and if there is a denial of intent, or if there's any dispute about intent, then bring out evidence that might bear on intent. If it turns out that the defense has nothing to do with intent, then the only purpose of this evidence is for the propensity inference.
Hicks was
we gave that advice in Hicks. We'd given that advice in Beasley. It was ignored here. I mean, how can one say this was a proper use of this evidence?
Well, Hicks was a different crime and was, in fact, a general intent crime. Hicks was not about possession with the intent to distribute. Hicks was about drug distribution. And there is an important distinction, because in possession with intent to distribute...
Have you ever read the Beasley case?
I'm not sure if I am familiar with the Beasley case, Your Honor.
I'm pretty sure you haven't.
But in the Hicks case, it does differentiate between general intent and specific intent. And as the government in specific intent crimes has to prove the defendant's state of mind. And when he indicates that he was just in the vicinity of drug dealing, this court, in a very long line of cases, has indicated that his intent is at issue, even more than it's issued generally with specific intent crimes without that defense. And so in order to prove that, the government is entitled to rely on 404B, which allows evidence of intent.
Well, it sounds like you're making the precise argument that was rejected in Beasley. We reversed the conviction in Beasley in the face of that argument that in every drug case, every intent to distribute case, the prosecutor can always admit evidence of prior drug dealings. That led to a clean reversal in Beasley. Well, I can't see why this is any different.
Well, let me address 2 points.
You need to persuade us that intent was being disputed in some way, and this was relevant.
Well, first, in the opening, the government must prove, in order to prove that he was not allowed to possess a firearm, we have to prove that he was previously convicted of a felony. So that was stipulated by the defendant, his prior conviction. So there was nothing about this in the opening other than he's got a prior felony conviction. With respect to the specific drug dealing at issue, the district court did not allow it in until after the defense made the argument that he was just an innocent bystander. And so that takes it out of the general case.
And that argument has nothing to do with intent. The argument is, these weren't my drugs. I was found in a place where there were drugs. Right? It's perfectly consistent with a belief that if they were my drugs, I would have intended to distribute them. But they weren't my drugs.
He did not admit that if they were his drugs, he would have intended to distribute them. I had to prove that. The government had to prove that at trial.
Well, they were packaged. That wasn't a big issue, right? Let's try taking this issue away from the drug context. Suppose you've got a defendant who's got a prior bank robbery conviction. He's overheard. He's present while two other people are planning a bank robbery. One of them later takes a substantial step in that direction. And the defendant is charged with attempted bank robbery. Specific intent crime. He says, you don't have any evidence against me. I was present, but I had nothing to do with this. Are you allowed to bring in the prior bank robbery conviction?
If he is charged with attempted bank robbery, mm-hmm. attempted bank robbery.
Or conspiracy. So.
I'm not sure those are specific.
Attempt is usually a pretty specific intent crime.
Robbery yeah. Is a specific intent crime. You have to intend to deprive the victim of the property. It's part of the burden of proof.
Well, I'm not sure that's a general intent crime or a specific intent crime. I mean, distributing of drugs, you have to intend to distribute drugs, but this court has held that it's still a general intent crime. I don't know if I can distinguish the bank robbery context, Your Honor. I think that we'd have to analyze it under 404B and under what circumstances was the previous conviction, how similar is it. I don't think it would come in, Your Honor. I think it is.
And how is this different?
Because it involves his presence with drugs and what he was intending to do with the drug with drugs, and he in his prior drug distribution case. And by the way, we did not admit that conviction until after he testified. It was just the facts of that case that the district court admitted with a limiting instruction. But in this context, we had to show that he intended to distribute the crack cocaine that was found in his house. And his prior admission of prior distribution of crack cocaine was relevant to his intent. And I don't think a prior bank robbery would be relevant to a subsequent bank robbery's intent.
Once a bank robber, always a bank robber. Once a drug dealer, yeah. always a drug dealer.
Well, the argument you're making sure sounds like the propensity inference.
Well, it is really only about his intent. And once a bank robber, always a bank robber, obviously is exactly the inference prohibited by Rule 404B and is not the inference that the jury was instructed very specifically on in the jury instructions to use that evidence, which is just for his intent and his knowledge.
That is not a very – I mean, I know it's the standard instruction, but it's also opaque to most lay people.
Well, I see my time is up. If the court does not have any further questions, I ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Cole. Anything further, Mr. Allport?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd just like to address one point.
Mr. Cole told you that this affidavit at issue here was sparsely detailed, but that was the only reason he said just besides that, they should still be entitled to good faith. He didn't present a reason why this affidavit doesn't cross that boundary for Leon and why the police should be entitled to good faith in this case. It is so sparsely detailed that this is exactly the case where the court should exercise the exclusionary rule. If there are no more further questions, I will finish. Thank you very much, Your Honors. And we ask that you overturn Mr. Miller's conviction and grant him a new trial.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Allport. And we appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept this appointment and your assistance to the court as well as your client. The case is taken under advisement.